Exciting news from the EAN. Since January 2025, EAN Campus is open to all associate members. If you're part of a National Neurological Society in Europe, you may already have access. Just log in with your MyEAN account at eancampus.org and explore top quality content. More details in the episode description.
Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to EAN Cast, Weekly Neurology. My name is Marian Galovic and I'm consultant neurologist at the University Hospital in Zurich. Today we're diving into normal pressure hydrocephalus, a condition that is often overlooked but highly treatable. And to explore it, I'm joined by Per Christian Eide. Professor Eide is professor of neurosurgery at the University of Oslo and director of K.G. Jepsen Center for Brain Fluid Research at the University of Oslo. Thanks for joining us today, Professor Eide. So my first question to you is, what is normal pressure hydrocephalus and why should neurologists and neurosurgeons care about it?
Well, first, Marian, thank you for the invitation. I'm happy to be here and to talk about normal pressure hydrocephalus. I think that's an important disease. Well, what is it? I consider it as a CSF proteinopathy. It combines CSF disturbance and also abnormal accumulation of toxic proteins in the brain. So in that sense, it's comparable to other kind of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. So actually, I think that neurologists should be interested in this disease as they are interested in Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. So that aspect of normal pressure hydrocephalus, in my mind, has been overlooked. Obviously, it's a CSF disorder, but it's not only a CSF disorder. It also has other aspects to it.
So what are the classical symptoms of normal pressure hydrocephalus?
Well, the syndrome, so to say, was described many years ago, back in the 1960s. And the typical symptoms are gait disturbance, urinary incontinence, and also cognitive impairment. And this is then combined with radiological signs of ventriculomegaly. And if measurements of CSF dynamics are assessed, then abnormal CSF dynamics may as well be shown.
Is it common that all of those symptoms are present, or does it sometimes happen that some or part of the triad is not present and you can still make the diagnosis?
Yes, for sure. And sometimes only a set of the symptoms are present. The most typical is the gait problem, and then to a variable degree also the other aspects of the disease are present. So also this is reflected in the guidelines that presently are used. It's not a requirement for the diagnosis, so to say, that all of the symptoms are present. So this is variable. And also there is some kind of disagreement, so to say, how many of the symptoms should be present to denote it idiopathic normal pressure hydrocephalus.
So what is the gold standard for making the diagnosis of normal pressure hydrocephalus? And how would you distinguish from mimics like other neurodegenerative disorders?
So the current gold standard is a combination of the symptoms as well as radiological signs. And then there is a debate whether CSF dynamic tests should be included. Many places or institutions will use the TAP test, while other tests are used to a variable degree in other institutions. So I would say that the current gold standard relies on the combination of symptoms and radiology, and then it depends how much CSF dynamic testing is done in addition.
So how would you measure the response to a TAP test clinically or objectively even?
Well, that is done differently in the different institutions. So, of course, that's a question and a debate how it should be recorded. And that's part of the problem with the TAP test as well, that neurologists and physicians are assessing this test variably around. Preferably, there should be some kind of objective testing before and after tapping on CSF. Another question is, when should assessment be done? And some patients will report improvement after many hours, even the next day after CSF tap. So there is a discussion about that. And there is no distinct answer how it should be done. But I think some kind of objective testing would be preferable.
Excellent. And I believe the symptom triad that you described, it may have some overlap with other conditions in older people, such as Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease. So how would you distinguish normal pressor hydrocephalus from these conditions?
So for sure, that's a difficult aspect because, as you comment, there is often much comorbidity in these patients. And we very well know that cardiovascular comorbidity is common. And there is overlap towards other dementia subtypes. So I think, at least in our experience, we prefer that these patients are always assessed by a neurologist before referred to neurosurgery. And the clinical assessment of the patients regarding comorbidity or the diseases should not be underestimated. So that's part of the problem, so to say, with this disease, that the symptoms may mimic other causes. So again, back to this aspect that this is this IMPH disease both involves CSF disturbance and also this neurodegenerative aspect. I also would like to comment that even though the symptoms may resemble or be linked to other diseases, this may not prevent referral to neurosurgical assessment because sometimes there is the disease, the IMPH disease, is combined with other diseases, and this may not prevent a shunt response in the patients. So this is also something to have in mind.
I also guess that seeing enlarged ventricles or hydrocephalus on the MRI may be confusing because this can happen during normal pressure hydrocephalus, but also if there's a large degree of atrophy in the brain. So could you give me a hint how atrophy can be distinguished from hydrocephalus or proper hydrocephalus on the MRI?
So this is a good question because, as you know, the ventricles enlarge with age and also because of other diseases like atrophy. And during the last years, there has been increasing attention on imaging markers that could be indicative of normal pressure hydrocephalus. And then it's useful with these various markers like the colossal angle, when there is a narrowing of this. This is one sign of the disease. Also, this dash sign disproportionately enlarges subarachnoid space hydrocephalus, where there is tightening at the vertex and enlargement of the subarachnoid space in the sylvian fissure. This is another sign, and periventricular white matter change is another sign. So each sign alone may not be very predictive for the disease, but in combination, these signs are helpful to diagnose the disease. So I think a good radiological assessment is always necessary in these patients.
Now, particularly in the older population, we do see quite many patients with hydrocephalus on the MRI. I'm wondering, how common is normal pressure hydrocephalus in the older population? What would your guess be?
So there are some reports on that, and people have tried to assess the prevalence of the disease among the elderly. And then they have used the guidelines, and it's typically a differentiation between possible and probable IMPH, and this relies on the symptoms and on the imaging signs. So actually the prevalence is very much higher, at least what has been reported during the last years, than we previously assumed. So there is one report from 2024 in neurology, where the prevalence among those aged 70 years was 1.5%. And others have shown that the prevalence above 80 years are 5%. So 5% above 80 years with signs of the disease. And these numbers are, in my mind, extremely high. And then, of course, you could question these results, of course, but then it's again a problem is that the ventricles enlarge with age, and also the symptoms that characterize IMPH also become rather frequent in all the patients or older people. So of course it's a big challenge to estimate the prevalence, as long as the disease is defined as it is today. So a correct answer to the question is difficult, actually.
Yes, but I agree, those are really high numbers. So in general, in clinical routine, do you think normal pressure hydrocephalus is rather overdiagnosed or underdiagnosed? What's your opinion?
My opinion is that this disease is clearly underdiagnosed. So most patients are left untreated. Of course, this differs between regions and probably countries. It highly depends on the awareness among physicians, particularly neurologists, neurosurgeons, geriatricians.
Okay, so there's a lot of unmet need regarding normal pressure hydrocephalus. Which factors contribute to the development of normal pressure hydrocephalus?
Well, the etiology of the disease is unknown. So there is a lot of discussion what causes the disease. We have some hints. It's probably closely associated with neurovascular function. So when we have examined brain tissue in histological specimens, There are changes to the blood-brain barrier. There is leakage across the blood-brain barrier. There are surrounding the vessels signs of astrogliosis, and also loss of the aquaporin 4 along the end fit of the astrocytes. So the vascular function is probably important. We know we have limited information about the role of immunology in the disease. It's a peculiar sign that the disease appears in the late 60s and with a top around 70 years of age or 72 years of age. So the age aspect is important. For sure, this disease is multifactorial. So it's not one particular cause, probably, to the disease. It's probably a combination of factors.
There is increasing interest in the role of sleep in CSF dynamics and CSF clearance. Does sleep play a role in the pathophysiology of normal pressure hydrocephalus as well?
Yes, it seems to play a role. And sleep is then particularly related to what we could call the brainwashing system of the brain or the glymphatic system of the brain. And then we are addressing the brain's ability to clear waste because the brain is a supercomputer, as we know, and it's using a lot of energy, and all energy processes are creating waste. And so also be the brain. And there is a production of proteins every day, and some of the proteins are dangerous or toxic. And the most well-known proteins are the amyloid beta and the tau and alpha-synuclein in Parkinson. And this clearance process seems to depend on sleep because during sleep, the waste clearance or brainwashing, so to say, is enhanced. So poor sleep quality is associated with reduced clearance of waste and thereby increased risk of abnormal protein aggregation in the brain. And well, then we are talking about the proteinopathy aspect of INPH, so to say, or the abnormal aggregation of toxic proteins in the brain. So that's addressing more this aspect of the disease rather than the CSF disturbance aspect itself. Even though we think that during sleep, CSF mediated transport perivascular in the brain is enhanced. So indirectly also CSF is involved, but it's basically related to the brain washing aspects.
So far we discussed making the diagnosis and pathophysiology. Let's say we have a patient who meets the diagnostic criteria for MPH and responded to a TAP test. What are the treatment options for this patient?
The current treatment options primarily relate to shunt surgery. So it's a neurosurgical procedure where a shunt system is implanted in the patient. It requires a ventricular catheter to the brain ventricles, a valve to regulate the CSF diversion, and then a distal catheter that either is placed within the peritoneum or into the heart. So the current treatment is a CSF diversion system.
And what if a patient does not respond to shunt surgery? Do they still qualify as having NPH, or does the diagnosis need to be revised?
This is a very good question. And actually, the guidelines that we have today, we have the Japanese guidelines from 2021 and the American European guidelines for 2005. And according to these guidelines, it's possible, so to say, to have the diagnosis without a shunt response. So in that sense, addresses the problematic aspect of INPH in the sense that INPH is essentially defined by its response to the one treatment there is, namely the shunt operation. On the other hand, it's possible to have the diagnosis without a shunt response. So obviously that's a challenge and a problem. So the answer is yes, it's probable to have the diagnosis without a clinical response to the only treatment, namely the shunt surgery. And why is it like that? Well, then my answer would be that this is a combined disease. It's both a CSF disturbance disease and a neurodegenerative disease, or call it a proteinopathy disease, abnormal aggregation of toxic proteins in brain. And the current problem is that we only have one treatment, the shunt operation, that essentially addresses the CSF disturbance aspect. So if the neurodegenerative aspect of the disease has come too far, then the operation will not help. And perhaps there is some kind of analogy to, for instance, Alzheimer's disease. We know that if the disease has progressed a lot, then you can give all kind of treatment, but you will not reverse it. So it's in that sense, there is some kind of resemblance.
Okay, so you're saying that response to treatment depends on the timing, and if you diagnose and treat NPH early, the response is likely to be better.
Yes, would be the right thing to say, yes. So it's preferable to treat it before it has come too far.
What is in there for the future of normal pressure hydrocephalus treatment, diagnostics, and research? What is your vision for the near or midterm future?
I think there are several aspects to that. Diagnosis is important. We need more, so to say, less invasive tests, preferably biomarkers, both based on CSF and, of course, preferably blood tests. We are not there today. I think that's important. And obviously, we need to understand better the disease, the mechanisms behind the disease, and then to be able to treat this based on the cause of the disease. And in the long term, we need some kind of medical treatment for the disease, for sure. So that would be the long-term goal. Even for me as a neurosurgeon, the goal would be to understand the mechanism behind it and then to provide more specific treatment for it.
And what is the most rewarding part of treating this condition for you?
Actually, we see a very good response in a large proportion of patients. There are many happy patients and families, and we get a lot of positive feedback. So that's the most important thing. I also think that the disease is quite fascinating, simply because we don't understand the cause of the disease. So from my viewpoint, that is also a very inspiring aspect of looking into this disease. And then remembering that probably the disease is very much more prevalent than we have thought before, that's still another fascinating aspect of it.
Per Christian, before we wrap up, if there is only one thing that neurologists and neurosurgeons should remember from today's podcast about normal pressure hydrocephalus, what would the main message be?
I would say neurologists should begin considering this disease as a combined CSF disturbance and neurodegenerative disease. Neurologists are interested in neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson, and they should remember that IMPH is another subtype, and that's why they should be interested in it.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Per Christian, Professor Eide. This was a fantastic talk about normal pressure hydrocephalus, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.